From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Dominic Chianese talks about The Sopranos. He's nominated for an Emmy for his performance as Uncle Junior. The season's finale concluded with Chianese singing an old Italian song at a family gathering after a funeral. Now he has a new CD of songs he'll perform in the studio. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD from NSYNC. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms has announced he will not seek re-election next year. The 79-year-old Republican says his age was a major factor in his decision. Helms says he never dreamed that he would have such a long tenure in the Senate when he was first elected.
You see, if my health continues to be good when my present fifth term ends at 2002, adjournment, I will be 81 years old, and I will then have served 30 years as a senator from North Carolina, longer than any other senator elected by the people of North Carolina. And not in my wildest imagination did it ever occur to me that such a privilege would ever be mine.
Helms made his announcement on WRAL-TV in Raleigh, the station where he was once a news commentator before entering politics. Members of President Bush's Commission on the Social Security System are dismissing concerns that the shrinking federal budget surplus could make their job more difficult. NPR's Pam Fessler explains.
The president's commission is trying to find a way to put the nation's retirement system on a sound financial footing while allowing some workers the option of private investment accounts. Panel members say they're concerned about the system over the long run and that lower surpluses over the next few years will not affect what they do. The commission's co-chairman, AOL Time Warner executive Richard Parsons, said the panel's looking at all the options, even cutting benefits for future retirees.
If the question is, have you looked at the impact of benefit adjustments downward? Yes. But have we made any conclusions regarding any of that? Not at this point in time.
Democrats are using the new surplus projections to argue that President Bush's tax cut has drained resources needed for other government programs, including Social Security. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli helicopter gunships fired rockets at a Palestinian vehicle in the Gaza Strip today. They killed one man but missed the militant who tops Israel's most wanted list. Four other Palestinians were killed in the West Bank, as NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Palestinians said four rockets hit the security car, killing the driver, a member of the security forces. The Israeli army declined immediate comment. The Gaza attack came several hours after a gunfight in the West Bank city of Nablus, in which four Palestinians were shot and killed by Israeli troops. The army said the Palestinians were planting a bomb along a road used by Jewish settlers. Also in the Gaza Strip, Israeli surface-to-surface missiles slammed into a Palestinian police station, wounding seven policemen and one civilian. The violence comes as Israel and the Palestinian Authority take halting steps toward a meeting aimed at bringing about a ceasefire. Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres is believed to favor a zone-by-zone approach to a ceasefire. Palestinian President Yasser Arafat has agreed to meet with Peres, but a time and place have not been set. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
On Wall Street today, the Dow gained 102 points. The Nasdaq was up 28. This is NPR. Hundreds of NATO troops are headed for Macedonia after leaders of the alliance decided today that the ceasefire in the Balkan nation is stable enough to allow the full contingent of troops to be deployed. The NATO troops will be taking part in a short-term operation to gather up weapons from ethnic Albanian rebels. The collection effort will begin next week. Investigators in Los Angeles say arson was the cause of last week's deadly explosion at a hotel in Hollywood. Two people were killed and 50 residents were evacuated in the pre-dawn fire that witnesses say began with a blast. NPR's Mandalito Barco reports.
Arson investigators say someone poured about 40 gallons of gasoline throughout all four floors of the Palomar Hotel, fueling an explosion and a fire. LA's fire chief says the gas vapors were ignited by a water heater behind a stairwell on the first floor of the dilapidated building. The hotel manager died, and so did a woman who fell to her death from the top floor after handing her two children to firefighters. Two of the firefighters who were badly burned have undergone skin graft surgery. About 17 of the hotel residents remain in a Red Cross shelter. Investigators still don't know who caused the fire or why. Mandalit del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The space shuttle Discovery glided to a safe landing at the Kennedy Space Center today after an earlier landing opportunity was scrubbed because of bad weather. Among the passengers aboard were the two astronauts and one Russian cosmonaut who spent the last 5 months aboard the International Space Station. They made the flight to Earth in reclining seats so the blood would not rush from their heads after their prolonged stay in the weightless environment of space. Doctors say all three have been checked out now and are in good condition. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A couple of weeks ago, HBO started to rerun all the episodes of The Sopranos in sequence on Sunday nights. My guest, Dominic Chianese, is nominated for an Emmy for his role in The Sopranos as Uncle Junior. You may also know him from his role in Godfather II as Johnny Ola. On The Sopranos, Uncle Junior is often at odds with his nephew, Tony Soprano, with Junior representing the old way of doing things. Junior has even taken out a hit on Tony, which failed. Here's a scene from the final episode of this past season with Uncle Junior talking with Tony, played by James Gandolfini. Junior has been released from his period of house arrest.
Well, Bobby says you're out from under the house arrest. Congratulations.
The lawyer was finally able to demonstrate I don't pose a flight risk. Flight risk. I've been farting into the same sofa cushion for the last 18 months. Your week or trial's coming up, though.
At least you're out. Then you're eating regular food again.
An illness changed my whole viewpoint. I'm going to stop and smell the roses.
We all should. I mean, what the f***?
The season finale ended with the family gathering at a restaurant following the funeral of Jackie Jr., the son of the late mob boss and the boyfriend of Tony's daughter, Meadow. At the restaurant, Uncle Junior sings an old sentimental Italian song. The song brings tears to the eyes of some of the oldsters in the crowd, but to Meadow, it's pure hypocrisy, and she storms out of the restaurant with Tony chasing after her. Chianese also sings on a new CD called Hits, which features Italian and American songs, including a couple of originals. He'll perform in the studio, but first, here he is on the season finale.
Come on, Junior, sing it!
Junior!
Come on!
What the hell? I beat cancer. Now I'm gonna beat the can. Nah, that's too high. No, bring it down. Bring it down. Yeah. Cadari.
Perché mi dighi sto parole amar? Perché me palio core mi dormiente cadarì non te scordare.
Dominic Chianese, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's so nice. Aria fresca.
How did you end up singing in the final episode of The Sopranos?
The writer, David Chase, decided to use, my talent as a singer. And he had heard me singing a song at a party at Lorraine Bracco's house one night, and he had asked me the title of the song. And when I mentioned the title, Cor Ingrato, and what it meant, Ungrateful Heart, it seemed to have some kind of responsive chord went up in this writer's mind. And about a year later, he put it into the script and completely surprised me.
I know you've brought your guitar with you. Can I ask you to sing a few bars of the song that you sang on the final episode of The Sopranos?
Sure.
Cadari, cadari, perché mi dighi sto parole amare?
che me palio cuore mi turmiente cadari non te scorda che t'ha giurato cuore cadari non te scorda.
It's a long song.
What does that translate to?
Catherine, do not forget that I gave you all my heart. And why do you come with me with such bitter words that tell me you're leaving me? And why do you have an ungrateful heart?
How do you know the song?
This is a song that's been in literature, I imagine, I mean, in music, around a good 50 years at least, as far as I know. And I remember Seymour Pensner, a wonderful old actor, was playing it one day in the studio in, back in the early 60s, I remember. I said, God, it's a beautiful song. And he said, yeah, you should learn it, Dominic. And we were doing a show on the road, I think. So it came about through, you know, through music, through theater. Lovely song, written by Cardillo, his name is.
How did you start singing?
Singing started, I would imagine it started with Grandpa Domenico when I was a little boy. In the Bronx, he would always open a window on the weekends when I'd stay with my grandmother and grandfather and just sing out the window, you know, a cappella and old Neapolitan folk songs, popular songs. You know. And I've since come to realize, Terry, that he did that for me. I was a first grandson. The other grandchildren, the other boys, he would take fishing and mushroom hunting and things like that. But with me, he would realize, no, he sang because he knew I liked music. So he would sing, and he was my first influence.
So he sang That's out the how. Window as if the street was his audience and the window was his theater?
Yeah, it was in the Bronx, and we'd just sing out there. It would usually be on a weekend. He was on the third floor, I remember. So it was in Kingsbridge, actually. When they moved away from Southern Boulevard, they moved up to Kingsbridge, up in a little bit more country up there in the Bronx in those days. And in those days, you had a lot of natural sounds, piano tinkling, guitar playing, a saxophone. You know, you didn't have much. Not too much traffic and not too much TV. There was no TV, actually. So you could hear voices. That's interesting. I never thought of that. But he sang for me, and he sang for his wife. My grandma was in the kitchen, too. And it would be just a two-room apartment, you know, in the Bronx. It was lovely.
Do you do any songs on your new CD that you knew as a child?
That's a good question. I think I did the Ramona on my CD. It's an old popular song written by Mabel Wayne, I think was the name of the writer. There's an Italian song on there, Stay Close to Me, which is a very old song in Italian, in Neapolitan dialect. And Santa Lucia, too. Yeah, that was also on it.
Would you do a few bars of Stay Close to Me?
Sure, I'd be happy to. This is a beautiful song that in Italian, Sarti Vicino a Me. State vicino a me, pena da sera. Tu non puoi sapere come si cara. La carezza me come c'è, la carezza luna. La carezza me come mar, la carezza arena. Fammi dormire. Come te la giari. Those old Italian men were great whistlers too. He taught me how to whistle, Grandpa.
Oh, I love that kind of whistling. Yeah. Wish I could do that.
They used to whistle a lot. You got to develop the buccinator muscles.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dominic Chianese, and he plays Uncle Junior on The Sopranos. Let's talk a little bit about your role on The Sopranos.
Sure.
Why don't you describe your character?
He's grouchy, tunnel vision kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
Very opinionated about certain things, and he's a very local person. I mean, I don't think he thinks too much about global issues, and he really gets mad at soap opera characters if they don't do the right thing. He's really into, he's kind of a likable guy in a lot of ways, And he has some funny expressions sometimes.
Yeah, what are some of your favorite lines that get quoted back at you by your fans?
Well, I was in Kentucky a few months ago at the Derby, and these two guys come over to me. We're going to take a picture with you, Dominique. I said, okay, great, let's take a picture. And they hand me the badge. They were federal marshals. I got the badge. I got the badge on my jacket now. Federal marshals. They say, we want you to have this as a token of our appreciation. They were funny guys. They didn't say, because I have a great line about federal marshals being, you know, they're so far. You sure I can say it on the air? Yeah.
I'll tell you what. Why don't you say
I'm
it?
I'm a very conservative guy by nature. Until my mother died, she died at 93 last year. She said to me, you curse so much, she said. She had never heard me curse, you know. Uncle Junior, of course, doesn't care. He curses. But I never curse.
You can say it. I think it's okay to say it.
Well, the federal marshals are so far up my ass, I can taste Brill Cream.
Yeah, that's one of the famous lines from the series. Now, in your role as Uncle Junior, you wear these big black plastic rectangular eyeglasses.
Yes.
I think
yes.
Those eyeglasses really change your look. It changes your face. It changes your eyes.
Yeah, it does. And that's very important, as you know, in film. You know. No, it really does. And to me, I love them because they're a mask. And I don't think I can do Uncle Junior without them now. They're really a part of his mystique.
How do they change you when you put them on? What do those glasses say to you about his sense of style or lack of style or personality?
Well, I like it because I didn't realize it, but I kept saying he has tunnel vision. The glasses, if you turn them around, everybody would look like the other end of the Holland Tunnel. But also, and then when you use them the right way, everybody's head is bigger. So it distorts his vision, which is an interesting metaphor, I think, for him.
Well, it makes your eyes look bigger.
Yes, and everybody else's eyes to me, too, look bigger. So it distorts his vision. They're magnified. Well, I find them very good.
It seems to me like they distort your vision because they're probably the wrong prescription for you.
They do. For a while I had to get used to it, but my eyes accustomed to it quickly. But I can't walk with them, you know, because everything is blurred.
Why didn't you say to them, give me just kind of plain glass so I could still be wearing these glasses, but I can
see? I learned a long time ago in college, I think. It was at Brooklyn College, that you don't argue with people's visions. You try it first, you know, before you say something. And I decided to do that with the glasses. They spent about a couple of hours, I remember, early part of the first episode, experimenting. And I knew they were doing it for a reason. And I said to myself, why are they doing these things with these fakakta glasses? I mean, it's ridiculous. I was going turn to left, turn right. And I remember Henry Brunkstein, the producer, we were laughing. I said, 40 years of acting lessons, shot to hell, you know, you're working with these glasses.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dominic Chianese, and he plays Uncle Junior on The Sopranos. He sang in the last episode of the season, and now he has a new CD of him singing. It's called Hits. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is okay. Fresh Air. My guest is Dominic Chianese. He plays Uncle Junior on The Sopranos. He also sings, and he's just put out his first CD. It's called Hits. Is there a character who Uncle Junior reminds you of in real life who you can draw on to create Uncle Junior?
Yes, definitely. There are people in my own family who had great senses of humor and funny lines, and they were just natural comedians, and there were a load in my neighborhood, people like that, including my own father. My father, once in a while, would throw a line out, you know, that would be quite funny, sotto voce kind of, you know, deadpan kind of thing. You get that a lot, I think, in Italian-American culture. I notice that a lot with uncles and things. That's a good way of putting it, because it's really, it reminds me of people, Uncle Junior, and it's way down there in the, you know, in my subconscious about the lines and senses of humor. Very, very, you know, very, very Italian-American.
What kind of neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up in that kind of very working-class neighborhood in the Bronx, you know, on Arthur Avenue, where there was everybody, the butcher, the bakers, the candlestick makers, the, you know, the doctors, the lawyers, but most of the people were plasterers, bricklayers, store owners, you know, you name it. Typical neighborhood, but working class neighborhood in a sense.
Did you grow up thinking that there were a lot of wise guys in the neighborhood?
Well, I didn't have to think about it. You'd see them in, hanging out in the corners. They had hats, and my father would point them out to me. Those are racketeers, he would call them, you know, because I'd ask, you know. They're racketeers. That's all he would say. Yeah, they're racketeers. And I figured they were shooting crap in the streets, shooting dice. But when I was a little boy, you could see police cars stop sometime near the public school, and you're on the way to school, and all these guys would be running away from this unmarked police car. People would be chasing them down the street. You know, we thought it was part of the neighborhood, you know, because it was illegal to shoot dice in the streets. That's how it was back in the Depression days when I was a baby, yeah.
Did they have a look about them that was different from the look of the other mothers and fathers in the neighborhood?
No, they just ran faster than most people. they ran a little faster. They usually were young guys, you know, 18, 19, 20, whoever. Maybe they turned up to be mastermind criminals later on. Who knows?
Now, I want to ask you about one of the episodes of The Sopranos. One of the subplots here, you had a younger girlfriend, and you performed oral sex on her, not on camera. And that is apparently not something that you're supposed to do if you're an Italian man, according to the Soprano scripts. So when word gets out that you're doing this, you have to you have to give her up because the whole thing is so embarrassing. What was your reaction to that storyline?
As a character, you mean, or as Dominic?
Both. As yourself and as the character.
I saw the humor in it. It's very funny, I think. I was getting a big ribbing from Jimmy. I remember he said, "Wait, did you read the episode?" Yeah, I said, "Not yet." He said, "Will you read it?" He said. He started laughing, and they were all teasing me. "Oh, you're going to love this one, Dominic." You know, all the guys teased me about it. My reaction was that I thought it was very clever, and yet as funny as it is, there's a lot of meaning to it. I thought because Uncle Junior probably I always wonder why first of all he never married, right? I noticed he never married Junior. And probably his sex life is very, very, very private to him. You know, like most men, I think, Italian men. And she was younger. And I think his pride was probably upset as a man, you know. So my reaction was that it's very good. It's a good gimmick. And he probably would get angry with her because he warned her not to say anything. And I guess he's a bit of a controller. I just think it's very normal, I think. You know? Hey, I'm a good Catholic kid. I can't go into it too deeply.
Were you at all embarrassed by this subplot?
Oh, no. God, no. No, Robin Peterson was such a wonderful actress to work with. God, she was funny. She was great, I thought, you know.
So many Sopranos fans want to know what's going to happen next on the series. What are you told by the producers of the show or the writers of the show about how to protect these secrets?
Well, we're given a script maybe anywhere from 4 days to a week ahead of time. But 3 or 4 days before we start shooting the episode, we're all gathered around a table. And the producer and David will make a very short speech about please try to keep it confidential, especially to the people who are coming in new to the episodes. You know, we don't know ahead of time. I never ask, and I'd rather be surprised. But the writers are working, you know. They're only probably a couple of episodes ahead of us. So it is private.
You know, Uncle Junior had cancer. Were you worried that he was going to die of cancer and you'd be out of the series?
Well, I'd been on soap operas before, you know, and I had a feeling that he had to fight the cancer. And the only thing I was thinking about, I said, God, can I be sick and still stay on the show for a season or two? I really wasn't worried too much, but David Chase, the nice guy that he is, he sort of intimated to me. He said, "Don't worry, we're not going to kill you." You know, in case I was worried, you know, he actually came over to me one day and told me that, and I thanked him for that because we all worry about getting bumped off.
Sure. It can happen to anyone on the show.
It could happen to anyone on the show. Anyone, yeah. It's part of the world that these characters live in.
Dominic Chianese is nominated for an Emmy for his performance as Uncle Junior on The Sopranos. Here's a scene from the first season of the show. Uncle Junior is visiting his sister-in-law, Tony's mother, Livia, in her nursing home. While they talk, a performer is entertaining the residents with his Ed Sullivan impersonation.
I think we may have a bad apple.
Does Tony know about this? What are you going
to
do?
There's not much to do. We have to sit back and wait.
Now for the youngsters.
And do me a favor. Don't let Tony know you know. He's under enough pressure.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure he's telling the psychiatrist it's all his mother's fault.
What are you talking about, a psychiatrist?
Yeah, a psychiatrist. He's been seeing one for a while now. God only knows what he says.
Tony?
Yes, Tony. Tony, who had such a terrible mother.
A psychiatrist?
Yes, Junior, for Christ's sake.
Who? The psychiatrist.
Once again, Mr.
You think
Bob
I know?
Dylan.
What did you say to Tony about this?
Me? Nothing. I wouldn't give him the satisfaction. And, Junior, I don't want there to be any repercussions.
A psychiatrist?
You're a broken record. Yes, yes. Do I have to?
This lady is blind. Dear, I have a few words for you. May our Lucy in the sky with diamonds, all right? Picture yourself in a boat at Ellis Island, all right? How does that sound?
Dominic Chianese will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Moon Women by Pamela Duncan, a novel about three generations of women in a Southern family. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Dominic Chianese talks more about The Sopranos and about his role in Godfather 2 as Johnny Ola, Hyman Roth's messenger boy. And Ken Tucker reviews the new CD from NSYNC.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dominic Chianese. He's nominated for an Emmy for his role in The Sopranos as Uncle Junior, Tony Soprano's uncle. He also has a new CD called Hits, on which he sings Italian and American songs. Now, let's talk about an earlier movie that you were in, Godfather 2, in which you play Johnny Ola, one of Hyman Roth's associates. And he's the guy that Pantangeli describes to Michael Corleone as Hyman Roth's Sicilian messenger boy.
Mm-hmm.
He's also the guy that Fredo says he was talking to, which tips off Michael that Fredo has been betraying the family by working with Hyman Roth. Would you describe your character of Johnny Ola?
Yeah, Johnny Ola was Hyman Roth's most trusted confidant, and so that the any setups with the Corleone family, as far as trying to eliminate them as rivals, would come through Johnny, because he knew how to handle Fredo Corleone. He knew that Fredo had a weakness, and he found that weakness, you know, and used jealousy to. Because if you think about Godfather, Fredo is, even says it in the movie, he was bypassed by Pop, by their father. And I think that's something you can always use. You can turn brother against brother with that.
I want to play a scene from Godfather 2, where here you are as Johnny Ola in a restaurant with Michael Corleone, played by Al Pacino.
The casino you're interested in, the registered owners are Jacob Lawrence, Alan Barkley, both Beverly Hills attorneys. The real owners are the old Lakeville Road group from Cleveland and our friend in Miami. Maya Klingman runs the store. He owns a piece of it, too. He does all right. But I've been instructed to tell you that if you move Klingman out, our friend in Miami will go along.
That's very kind of him. You tell him that's greatly appreciated.
Hyman Roth always makes money for his partners. One by one, our old friends are gone. Death, natural or not, prison, deported. Hyman Roth is the only one left because he always made money for his partners.
And that's Dominic Chianese as Johnny Ola in Godfather 2. How did you get the part of Johnny Ola?
Well, Francis, earlier, before they had done Godfather 1, he called a lot of people down at the Gulf and Western building down on 57th Street, 59th Street, years ago, 1971, I guess, and had a long, maybe a good half-hour conversation with Francis. He was a young filmmaker with just, you know, a few films under his belt and hadn't done Godfather 1 yet. And we discussed for at least a half an hour. He asked me many intimate questions about where I was, how I grew up, was my family from Italy, and which part of Italy they come from. Basically, it was really my first film I had ever done. I'm theater trained. And then I went to Boston to do a play. And my Jeff Hunter called me one time. He said, Domin, you know, they're interested. Are you interested in coming down to New York to audition for him? They may be interested in you. And I said, no, I really don't. I said, I'm in Boston here with my wife and the kids at the time. I don't want to be in a film, you know. So I turned down The Godfather 1 thing. Later on, I found out through Francis, he was very nice. He said, no, Dominic said, we had you in mind for this part, you know. But I figured I'd use you in case we ever did a sequel. And I said, wow, I'm glad you did, Francis. So looking back, I realized, Terry, that he wanted actors who could play these characters who were, and if these actors were unknown on the film, all the better for, you know, for the realistic look.
Mm-hmm.
So I realized that I was just in the right place at the right time. I was just the right age, too. I was 40 when we did Johnny, I think. I did Johnny Ola, yeah. And French was a very young man, and Al was a very young man.
You want to describe how you're killed in the movie?
I'm killed by Al's bodyguard, played by the great Amerigo Tot, T-O-T. Amerigo was a sculptor by profession and an actor, had very strong hands. And I remember that when Francis said that he's killed with a coat hanger, I thought that was kind of strange. But then when I realized how strong Amerigo was, that he could strangle a man with his hand. In fact, Amerigo had been in the underground in in France and Italy and I think some other countries, Hungary or someplace, where he would actually would strangle the enemy. He was on our side. So when I realized how strong he was, I said, "You're going to take, you know, we had to shoot the scene 11 times." And but he did it. He could have done it with his bare hands. That's how strong the guy was. And I found it very hard to do because Francis wrote in the script that Johnny Ola's neck goes limp. His image, I think, was that it was a snake, that you break his head. That was the image that they saw of Johnny. He was a snake, and he was, as far as his character. You know, slippery guy. And
so it was hard to get that limp look?
It was hard to get that limp look. I said, Francis, my neck doesn't go that way. He said, well, do the best you can, you know. So I was never happy about that death scene. It looked dramatic, but, you know, it was a quiet, it's like killing a snake. There's no sound. It was a good image.
Have most of your movie parts been mob guys?
No, I played priests and judges, and I never played any as much comedy on film like as I would have loved to do. And Justice for All, I think, was the most comedic part I had probably had ever done up until that time. And then I usually play authority figures of one kind or another, people who were always giving advice of one kind or another. And theater is where I had a chance to do other things.
How did you get your part on The Sopranos? Had David Chase seen you in The Godfather? I mean, in Godfather 2, was that part of the reason why you were cast?
Oh, no, I imagine that when George Ann Walken and Sheila Jaffe...
Oh, the casting directors, yeah.
They casting directors. They brought me in. I'm just the right age for Uncle Junior. And David hadn't known me. And the second callback, I remember, as I was auditioning, I heard this real laugh, you know, like a kind of a quiet laugh, which I thought was very real. It wasn't a phony kind of thing. Sometimes producers try to relax you, you know, but he really laughed, I could see. And I said, I have a good choice for this. I strictly auditioned, Terry.
What was the audition scene you had to do?
It was that first scene with Nancy Marchand, with Livia, in the car. We had a read about that. When I said to her, you know, your son is, we may have to do something about your son. You know, it's funny, but yet it's very, very, very compelling scene, actually. And I didn't read with Nancy, but it was it's an excellent scene. It's the last scene in the episode of the first episode, where he's in a car with her and he's casting aspersions on her son and talking about the difference between the old-time mobster Johnny, her husband, and her son, who seems to be out of hand. He's laying the groundwork to get rid of it. And then, of course, she picks up on it, Livia.
Well, why don't we actually hear that scene?
Oh, that's a great scene, I think, yeah.
It's nice of you to pick me up for the party, Junior. At least somebody cares about me.
These kids today.
I suppose he thinks once he's got me locked in a nursing home, I'll die faster. And then he won't have to drive me anywhere. Well, if his father was still alive, you can bet your boots he'd show more decency and respect for his mother.
My brother John was a man among men.
He was a saint.
Anyway, lots of things are different now from Johnny's in my day.
What do you mean?
I'm not free to run my business like I want.
Oh, isn't that awful?
Just this week, your son stuck his hand in, made it 100 times more difficult for me. Plus, he thumbs his nose at New York.
Oh.
What are you going to do? He's part of a whole generation. You remember the crazy hair? And the dope? Now it's fags in the military.
Stop it, Junior. You're making me very upset.
I don't like to, Olivia, but I'm all Argento all the time. And I'll tell you something else. Things are down all across the board. A lot of friends of ours are complaining. We used to be recession-proof. No more. Can't blame it all on the Justice Department. Our friends say to me, Junior, why don't you take a larger hand in things? Something may have to be done, Livia, about Tony.
Dominic Chianese, as an actor, what do you like about the writing on The Sopranos?
The connection with a life They don't seem to ever to have, you know, God forbid, a funny line for the sake of a funny line, or they're well motivated lines. So the subtext is always there for me, and that's a sign of good writing. You know where it's coming from, and the more you think about the line, sometimes you realize, well, there's a better way of doing it too. You know, because it's sort of like those three-dimensional chess games. You know, you're looking at the top, but then there's something underneath, and there's moves you can make down there too. It's that kind of thing about acting that is really challenging to me, Terry. And I think I think theater trains us to, because if you do a show, let's say you open the show, and then two months later you're halfway into the run, or you're into the run for 2 or 3 months, and you realize, oh my gosh, you know, this is what the character's really saying. It's that kind of organic acting, I think, that the script allows, and that's important, I think.
Dominic Chianese is my guest, and he plays Uncle Junior on The Sopranos. He also has a new CD in which he sings. It's called Hits. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dominic Chianese. He plays Uncle Junior on The Sopranos. He also has a new CD on which he sings called Hits. Now, early in your career, and this was in the 1960s and early 70s, you were the MC at Gertie's Folk City in New York, which was very important during the folk revival. Who are some of the people who were performing there during the years you were the MC?
The youngsters at the time: Jose Feliciano, Arlo Guthrie, Emmy Lou Harris. Then you got people. Dave Bromberg was very young. Paul Sebel. A lot of young people came through there. Phil Oakes was quite young. They were all young. And then there, when I say young, I'm talking people in their 20s and early 20s. And then you had the great blues artists like Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, John Lee Hooker.
What was your job as MC?
My job was really just to talk to the people and introduce them to the crowd. And as I learned the guitar, little by little, Mike Porco, the wonderful owner, he would, he'd say, go up and sing some numbers. And then eventually he would hire me and put me on a program too, you know. So it was a good lesson, because I love music so much. And it was a good way for me to learn the guitar and to meet a lot of interesting, wonderful artists.
What kind of songs did you sing when you emceed?
I would sing an Italian song. I sang an Italian song to get the job, I remember, because Mike was from Italy, and I sang Chitarra Romana, I think. I only knew like a few chords, but I sang an Italian song because I knew he was Italian, and he hired me. Hey, I never heard of an Italian folk singer before, he said to me. How much you wanted to work here? I said, I'll give me $100 a week. He said, I'll give you 90. I said, all right, I'll take it. So eventually I got on a program, and Mike became a great friend. And I used to hang around with Sonny Terry and Brownie and Jose Feliciano. And everybody would be down in Gertie's Folk City, the cellar downstairs where everybody tuned the guitars and everything. It was a great time. And it was a time of course, a lot of political unrest and people, a lot of protesting of songs and things like that. But to me, it was all about expression and the First Amendment kind of thing.
Now, were your parents both from Italy? Did they grow up in the U.S. or in Italy?
No, not at all. They grew up here.
They grew up here.
In New York. They grew up right in New York. My father grew up in the Bronx. My mother grew up in the Bronx and Brooklyn, but mostly the Bronx.
And your grandparents were from Italy?
Grandparents from Italy, yes. Grandpa was a stonemason, and he came to America and married Grandma. This is my father's parents. He married her here. She was only 17. I think he was 25. He met her at a family function. And my mother's side, they came from the same town. So they were, let me think, were they married there? They could have, no, they must have been married here too. But they came from the same town in Sorrento. Yeah, my mother's side, the Morrows.
How did your parents feel about you going into acting?
Well, Mom never, my mother always encouraged me. By not discouraging me, even though she knew I was taking a risk. But she always, both my mom and dad realized that they had a kid who liked English and who was very good at, I started reading at an early age, so they always pushed me for education and, you know, did the best they could as far as getting an education. But Dad was, Pop was totally against the acting profession. He knew that it was going to be a rough time, and he was right about that, of course. But he had a soft spot in his heart for singing, and so if I mention singing, he seemed to know. He knew, and his father knew, my grandpa, they knew that I did have a talent for singing, and I guess they just liked singing so much that they. But they really did encourage me, in a sense. But they were not, pushing it too much. They would much rather be a school teacher.
Well, I want to congratulate you on your Emmy nomination for your performance as Uncle Junior. And I want to thank you for talking with us. Would you leave us with a song?
I'd be happy to. Here's a song from a new album called Typical New Yorker. And, of course, you can buy the album in all the stores. I'm a typical New Yorker, cement sidewalker. Been all over this town, from Bowling Green to Van Cortlandt. I've been up, I've been down. Never been to the Statue of Liberty, on top of old Empire State. A trip from Manhattan to an island called Staten. The ferry ride is great. To the Bronx and Brooklyn, Kings and Queens, I sing my roundelay. In the Central Park moonlight, I can't kiss the blues away. I've been hugged, I've been bugged, I've been towed, been tugged like a raft upon the sea. Though I love the prairies and the mountain canaries, New York is the place for me.
Thank you.
Nice talking to you, Terry.
Dominic Chianese plays Uncle Junior on The Sopranos. He also has a new CD called Hits. HBO is rerunning all the episodes of The Sopranos in sequence Sunday nights. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by NSYNC. This is Fresh Air. One of the most popular of the current wave of teen pop acts, NSYNC, has a new CD. It's called Celebrity. Rock critic Ken Tucker says it ushers in a new phase of self-consciousness for young music makers who aren't usually thought to be that way.
If I wasn't a celebrity, would you be so nice to me? If I didn't have cheese like every day, would you still want to be with me? If I couldn't buy you diamond rings and all those other expensive things, would you be so into me if I wasn't a celebrity? Lately.
That's NSYNC,
wondering and worrying whether their girlfriends, who by metaphoric extension are their young female fans, would like them as much as they do if they weren't famous. On one level, it's an absurd question, since the only way we know NSYNC is via their fame. And to these jaundiced eyes, I think at least two of the pudgier guys in this band wouldn't be teen bait were they not hooked up with the hit machine that is NSYNC. But on another level, the question that is the refrain of that title song I just played, "If I wasn't a celebrity, would you still be in love with me?" is very shrewd, since it suggests to that teen fan base that, for all their fame and wealth, NSYNC is just like you and me, insecure in matters of the heart.
Dirty pop.
Yo.
BT. Sick and tired of hearing all these people talk about what's the deal with this pop life and when is it gonna fade out? The thing you got to realize, what we're doing is not a trend. We got the gift of melody, we're gonna bring it till the end. Come on now.
Like a car I drive, what I wear around my neck.
All that matters.
Don't you recognize that it's just about respect?
It doesn't matter.
How the clothes I wear and where I go and why.
All that matters
is that you get hype and we'll do it to you every time. Come on
Don't
now.
You ever wonder why this music gets you high? It takes you on a ride.
That's Pop, the CD's first single, and once you get past the idea that it's just a canny variation on Michael Jackson's sound from a decade ago, the song is both catchy and interesting. It's the kind of song a lot of teen pop acts end up writing, the "Why Don't You Give Me Some Respect" song. Go back to the late 60s, and it's exactly the same kind of heartfelt whining the Monkees were doing when they, like NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys now, started writing their own material and directly addressing their critics. The Monkees' answer was to play their own instruments and try to make a hip movie called Head, co-written by Jack Nicholson and directed by Bob Rafelson. The strategy flopped for the Monkees. For NSYNC, like the Backstreet Boys, who to my ears have better ears for harmonies, the confronting of critics and asserting, as NSYNC does on Pop, that, quote, "what we're doing is not a trend," is, when accompanied by a terrific, eye-popping video, a very good career move. So far, their new CD hasn't sold as many copies as their previous one, No Strings Attached, but it sold 1 million copies its first week out and has clung to the upper reaches of the pop charts.
Tell me what kind of girl would want to play me. Tear me down and try to break me. Baby, how could you betray me? After all I've done for you. Took you there, bought you this, now it's not enough, babe. You better get your story straight, babe. Tell me why you want to play. I've had enough.
These games, they gotta stop.
Oh,
about to get pissed off.
Ooh, yeah.
You had to keep leading me on.
Baby, I thought you had me fooled, but I see right through you.
Looking into my eyes. You see a man who thought you loved me. Play me like a fool, but I see right through you. I look into your eyes, tell you what I see. I see a girl who ran game on me. You thought you had me fooled, but I see right through you.
The teen pop acts dominate a lot of music coverage these days. They drive pop cultural discourse. The Backstreet Boys' A.J. McLean goes into rehab for alcoholism, and it becomes an occasion for fans to look at their idols as fallible humans and themselves as young people on the verge of similar dangers. Britney Spears begins her career offering the information of her virginity as a selling point, but she sustains that career by dressing in a manner so provocative that she gets parents up in arms and her female fans perplexed. Gee, just recently dressing like your idol used to mean wearing layered, tattered clothes like Madonna. To be Britney, you have to expose your navel and yank your jeans down to posterior level. And do you really want to do that? Meanwhile, to stay with NSYNC, you have to know what they mean when they say, in the song I just played, "Does he freak you like I do?" And you have to accept the idea that these guys with sweet images now frolic at the Playboy Mansion on "Just Don't Tell Me That."
Just don't tell me that you are gone.
It used to be parents who had to break it to kids that the world can be a difficult, often frightening and confusing place, while their pop stars comforted them with fantasies of eternal love and dreamy idealism. Now the teen pop acts demand that their fans look at the world more realistically, or perhaps more jadedly. And I guess it's up to parents to reassure their kids that the world isn't always as cutthroat as NSYNC now presents it.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Amy Sallet, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Hold on. You know what? Can we back it up just a little bit? Sit back.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities. And Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Niagara Falls All Over Again, a novel by Elizabeth McCracken, the author of The Giant's House. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the forgotten story of Laura Bridgman, a deaf and blind girl who learned to read and write before Helen Keller. Also, a talk with actress and dancer Marge Champion. She starred in several movie musicals of the 50s. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.